Lessons of Afghanistan from a Maine Congressman and the Chief Government Watchdog. The 20th anniversary of 9/11 comes on the heels of the U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, and with the world watching what comes next as the Taliban begin to govern there. Among those watching closely, Maine 2nd District Congressman Jared Golden, who joined the Marines in the aftermath of September 11th and served combat tours in Afghanistan. Another man with ties to Maine is John Sopko, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. In reports, Sopko warned that the Afghani forces and government were not ready to fight on their own. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Golden and Sopko share their reflections at this moment. We'll also hear from members of Maine's Afghan community and retired U.S. Staff Sergeant Travis Mills. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Tomorrow, September 11th, marks a solemn anniversary for the nation. It was 20 years ago that Al-Qaeda attacked the United States, an attack that resulted in a war in Afghanistan that ended just a few weeks ago. Today, we are going to discuss the lessons from Afghanistan. Joining me, Congressman Jared Golden. He is serving his second term representing Maine's 2nd Congressional District, and he served in Afghanistan as an infantryman in the Marines in 2004. John Sopko is also with us, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. He has more than 30 years of experience in oversight and investigations as a prosecutor, congressional counsel, and senior federal government advisor. We invite your questions and comments. A brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at MaineCalling.org, find us on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us today. Congressman Golden, I will start with you and just ask, 2004, a long time ago, but knowing that you're following the events in Afghanistan closely, of course, as a member of Congress and as a member of the Armed Services Committee, what are your thoughts today as you reflect on the anniversary?
Well, I want to start reflecting on 9/11, Jennifer. I think that's a good place for us to start. So one key concern for me is that in this moment, as we are pulling, have pulled troops out of Afghanistan, it's really important, I think, that the country not forget the significance of 9/11 and honoring the victims of 9/11, remembering what happened that day how serious a catastrophe it was. We have to remember the families, the survivors of the victims who are still with us, the many first responders who gave their lives that day, and the many others who have continued to be impacted by their service, as we know so many firefighters and other first responders are impacted by exposures to toxins, to smoke inhalation, many of them fighting cancers and dying from cancers to this day. We got to stick by them, remember them, and make sure that we're taking care of them.
Do you worry? Do you have a sense that people are forgetting?
Not right now. In this moment, actually, I am encouraged to see how I think strongly the country is reacting to what's going on in terms of the withdrawal in Afghanistan. A lot of critique, people feeling upset about the way that it has been carried out by the Biden administration, despite the fact that I think a majority of Americans supported getting out of Afghanistan. It seems that people are very tuned in, paying attention, and in particular on this anniversary, 20-year anniversary of 9/11, I think thinking about that day and what it has meant for all of our lives and for the country over the last 20 years. So in addition to honoring the victims and the families and the first responders, I think we also have to spend the day and this anniversary thinking about everyone who responded and served in the 20 years since in our armed forces, many of them in Afghanistan, others in Iraq, in addition to other countries around the world as part of the global war on terrorism. Now's a good time to make sure that we are making clear how deeply we appreciate their service and honor the sacrifices of those who have given their lives.
John Sopko, it is your job to be the man who reflects on what we have been doing in Afghanistan for 20 years. People have said you are the watchdog. You are the person who has issued now 11 reports on our involvement in Afghanistan. Many people, of course, very surprised at how quickly the Taliban took over when U.S. troops pulled out. You were not surprised. You were the person who has been sounding the alarm bell for a long time. Yet when one reads your reports, it is not all doom and gloom. They are mixed reports. You say there is good and there is bad.
Oh, yeah. Just to correct you a little bit, we issued 11 lessons learned reports, which are massive reports looking at specific issues. But we've issued over 700 reports, including audits, inspections, investigations, et cetera. So we've been documenting it for a while. But before answering your question, can I just add something to what the congressman said? And I second his comments about, let's not forget, not only the victims of 9/11, but let's not forget the military, our U.S. military that did fight and did a good job. And even though many of my reports are very negative on the reconstruction, I think we should be clear that we've never criticized the soldiers and the military who fought. And we owe them a debt of gratitude. I think they have kept a terrorist attack from occurring here again in the United States for the last 20 years. So at this time, when I think a lot of people, and maybe the congressman has talked to more veterans than I have, but I think a lot of veterans feel very confused at the ending of this thing and why they went in and all that. And I don't think they should feel it was a waste. What they did was important.
That's a really important point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a very important point, John. And thank you for making it. And I couldn't agree more. I think there's a danger in this moment for some veterans to be left feeling, you know, what was all of this for? You know, why did I serve and sacrifice? Some people have been terribly wounded or have been struggling with their experiences in the years since they left the service. Others wondering, you know, why did the guy that I served with, you know, give his life over in Afghanistan? What for? And I want everyone to know, I personally have never done anything I'm more proud of than my service after 9/11 in Afghanistan. And I feel that way about everyone that served there. And they have fought and won every battlefield, every victory, every battle that they've been asked to fight. They've won. I think John can speak to that. The bigger problem being leaders in this country have not had a political vision for what our objectives were, other than counterterrorism and the hunt for bin Laden and the other perpetrators of 9/11, which, you know, some people would, I think, agree with me that we've been successful in getting bin Laden in dismantling al-Qaeda and continuing to fight back against terrorist threats like ISIS, and we need to continue that focus. But there's been a real lack of a political vision about what are we supposed to do with those battlefield victories and those gains made by our troops on the ground. And absent that, it's been very difficult to have a strategy that could lead to success.
John, do you agree?
Well, I do agree. And I think that was one of the problems in our latest report talks about that, you know, we really are not very good, by we, I mean the U.S. government, on these large scale operations that involve as much as people don't want to say it, it did include nation building. It included reconstruction. This is the largest reconstruction or development program the U.S. government has ever done in its history. I mean, it's larger than the Marshall Plan. Plus, it's in a war zone. And I think we are just not prepared to do something that big. And that was one of the serious problems. And it's not like we haven't done this before, and we're not going to probably do it again. I mean, we've done it three times in the last 50 years, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And because we're not prepared for it, we're probably going to do it as poorly as we do in Afghanistan, unless we stop, think, learn some lessons from this last 20 years, and try to do it better the next time. And, you know, our report talks about this is a slippery slope. And it's really easy to get into this again. I mean, we're doing something on a smaller scale in Africa right now, in Mali, Somalia, a number of other countries. We're even talking about doing something like this in Haiti, and we're not opposed to that if our policymakers say you got to do it, but at least be prepared to do it. And if I can answer one of your other questions, was there some success? Yes, of course there was. You know, we spent $145 billion on reconstruction, and there was some tremendous success for the Afghan people. I mean, if you think of where women and girls were when the Taliban were there last, that's improved tremendously for them. If you talk about developing a free and independent media, I think there was a show on Maine Public Radio just before this talking to some Afghan journalists. I mean, that was a beacon of success. The problem is all of it is at risk now. All of it is at risk now. Every gain we made is at risk now with this new regime.
I want to ask you a question. Also this morning on this station, the head of MI5 was speaking. That's the British intelligence service, rarely speaks, but he spoke today, and he said he does believe that the terrorism threat worldwide is reduced because of our presence in not our as in the U.S., but the Western forces' presence in Afghanistan over the last 20 years. John Sopko, do you agree?
I think so. I mean, I believe we did do it. The question is, will that risk increase now that we're not there? And, you know, that's beyond what my office has looked at. But I think it's concerned.
Congressman Goldman.
I think it's important to talk about that a little bit. And I do think it is open to.
You think it's open Golden?
Open to debate. So for me, one of the defining takeaways from 9/11 is, and this is why I think our veterans and our service members should hold their heads up with pride. And John pointed out, we have not had a follow-on 9/11 attack on the homeland. The terrorist threat remains. But to me, one of the takeaways is very simple. The United States will move heaven and earth if you attack us, if you attack the homeland, if you, you know, do anything like what happened on 9/11. We'll do whatever it takes to get justice and revenge and to protect our homeland. That go as far as invading a country, overthrowing the Taliban, keeping a presence there for 10 years before we found bin Laden. And when we did find him, I'm sure he thought he was safe in Pakistan. Our troops pulled off an amazing mission. The heroes that went in there and got bin Laden, I think it's just amazing what they did. But it ought to send a strong message to other terrorist organizations and leaders out there. If you choose this lifestyle, if you're threatening the United States, first of all, sooner or later, we're going to find out who you are and where you are. And when we do, we'll be able to come and get you at a time and a place of our choosing. And we've shown that in Iraq with ISIS, ISIL, so the Islamic State in the Levant. When we, under the Trump administration, got Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, our troops went in and took him out. He was a serious threat to the United States. Soleimani, who was running terrorist organizations and funding Hezbollah, you know, an Iranian militant leader, the Quds force, which was pushing, you know, the spread of terrorism around the Middle East. So the counterterrorism piece has to be a top focus for us. I think we've got the most capable military in the world and can continue to do counterterrorism. But I don't think we can have a troop presence on the ground in Afghanistan ongoing forever, or in Iraq, in Somalia, in Yemen, in Libya, in Pakistan, in Syria. I can go on. You know, we have to be, I think, more nimble and have a different strategy for counterterrorism than getting drawn in to these forever wars and these nation-building endeavors. And I think John has plenty of evidence that should call into question whether or not we can ever successfully engage in nation-building and counterinsurgency-type wars as a country. Perhaps it's a mission that we should not be asking our troops to carry out.
On the line with us now is Fatima Saidi. She is originally from Afghanistan and now works as the Grants and Contracts Manager with Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition. Fatima, thanks so much for calling in.
Hello.
Are you there?
Thank you.
Hi. Yes. Share a little bit of your own ties to Afghanistan.
I was born in Ghazni, which is around 2 hours away from Kabul, to the south of Kabul. And I was barely 2 years old when my family, the first time when Taliban took over, my family fled to Pakistan. I am a Hazara Shia from Afghanistan. So my family is, in a way, we are triple minority, you know. So I grew up because of the first time when the Taliban took over in a refugee camp in Quetta, Pakistan. And then after 9/11, my family decided to go back to Afghanistan and so-called rebuild the country, you know, be part of this new movement, the hope that American give to Afghans. And we came from across the world back to Afghanistan. My parents then spent 20 plus years rebuilding their life, their homes in Kabul. And then on August 15, once again, my family lost everything. My mom and my three sisters and my two brothers, they had to flee again, exactly the same way we did 24 years ago. And it's again, my family's basically homeless in Pakistan, just going from some relative or distant relative's house to house. And Pakistan, for some of you might not know, it's a police state. So everything you can't do, you can't have a job, you can't go to school, you can't receive money, you can't do all these things unless you're recognized as a refugee. And the state of Pakistan doesn't recognize refugees. So the only way you can be recognized is through United Nations. And the lines are so long. I mean, the stories that my family, the way they fled from Kabul, and it took them 4 days to reach to the border and get to Quetta. The stories are horrible. And my youngest sister is just 13 years old. I mean, she still can really barely sleep. She has all these nightmares. I agree. I was hearing your guest talking about it. We can't be in Afghanistan and fight for a forever war, you know. But at the same time, America needs to take responsibility. When America went to negotiate with Taliban, a terrorist organization that has been killing Afghans, and I'm not even talking about 9/11 and all those things. Taliban has been killing Afghans, not just after, they have been killing Afghans for the 30 plus years. They did a poll how many Afghans even think about Taliban. 80 plus of them said that no way. And the fact that it shows that when Afghans were holding to the plane of Americans, they knew that they might fall to their death. But they still were doing it because the fear is on the ground. And especially if you're a minority, especially if you're a woman, especially if you're ethnically minority and religiously minority, I cannot even imagine what our Sikh community in Kabul is going through and Kandahar is going through and all these provinces. I'm a Hazara. When the first time Taliban took over, they in Mazar Sharif, which is in a northern place, they went killed 10,000 plus Hazaras. And the reports were saying that there was no Hazara left to bury the bodies. They did the same thing in Bamiyan. They are doing exactly the same thing yesterday. In the past 2 days, they have been bombing and massacring and genociding in Panjshir, which is a Tajik province of Afghanistan. I think one of the things that I have been living in America, and I came as an international student. Sorry?
Oh, Fatemi, I just wanted to ask you, and I'm so, so sad to hear your family's story. Obviously happy that they are safely out, but also so heartbroken to hear your story. And I just want to know, I know so many of our listeners are wondering what they can do to help. What would you say to people in Maine who are wondering what they can do to help those who were able, refugees in Maine from who are able to be in Maine from Afghanistan and others? What would you say to those who are listening right now?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking that question. In the state of Maine, we have around 70 Afghan families, but they are divided in two groups. There is a group that came in 1970s. So these are very well connected. They have been living here for 40 years. but some of them still have relatives back home. There is a new set of arrivals, Afghans, that they were resettled by the Catholic Charities, our partner organization in the state of Maine, and they have their parents or whoever in Afghanistan, and some of them, their families might have gotten out to Pakistan, which is a lot of Afghans try to do. So what most people, and especially your listeners at this moment, they can reach out to organization and see, because different organizations have different programs. For us, we have received so many families trying to offer to host people. So we have that going. And unfortunately, as you might have heard, Maine is not one of the states that Afghan refugees will be resettled. But that doesn't mean that Afghan refugees will not come here. They might come where their families are. And we already have few families that have arrived. So we are trying. And also the other thing is, like, not all Afghans are eligible for social services that are eligible for, they are there for refugees because they have different status, and they come, some of them are sponsored, some of them are coming through P1, P2, or SIV, so they have different things. So the best thing would be to reach out to organizations that are helping Afghans. So then based on that,
sure,
they can say, you can help here.
I would like to jump in. This is Congressman Golden, and Fatima, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story, your family's story. First, let me offer to be helpful in any way I can through my office and staff. We're trying to help many individuals who are going through the SIV process and some of the other programs for eligibility to get here to the United States, some of whom have gotten out of Afghanistan, have successfully fled, and are now trying to get through the State Department process. So we're happy to help with that. If someone reaches out to my staff in our Lewiston office or Bangor office or our office up in Caribou. But in addition, just on the point about how will people that come here through SIV or some of the other programs that might help people to find refuge here in the United States coming out of Afghanistan, there is discussion in Congress about eligibility for assistance to make sure that people aren't coming here with nothing and being left in very difficult economic situations. Part of bringing folks here should, I think, entail making sure that they are well taken care of, housed, and fed, and then ultimately given opportunities to build a good life here. So the Congress is actually talking about legislation, working through the process right now to change some of those eligibilities and make sure that for those that do make it here, they're gonna be welcomed and given the support that they need financially, from a healthcare perspective, and then hopefully set up with education and work opportunities.
Fatima, thank you so much for calling in. Fatima Saidi, originally from Afghanistan, who works for the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from BCM Environmental and Land Law of Northern New England, helping landowners, farmers, and governments problem solve. BCMEnvirolaw.com. And Maine Coast Sea Vegetables, offering 8 species of organic wild seaweed from the North Atlantic. Learn more at seaveg.com. And CEI Maine, from heritage industries to the next big idea, providing advice and capital to help businesses grow. Learn more at ceimaine.org. Maine Public News Connect is a new initiative developed to provide the top stories from Maine Public News in translation. Thanks to the tremendous support of the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition, Jambo Africa, and other community partners, Maine Public News Connect releases new video reports every Friday afternoon by 3 o'clock. Our pilot program includes news translated into French, Spanish, Portuguese, and Somali. You can find Maine Public News Connect reports online at mainepublic.org and on our social media platforms today at 3 p.m. From bakeries to breweries, shoe shops to solar, a wide variety of businesses and organizations throughout Maine support this service. They understand the value of public radio and want to support it, and they want to reach you, the public radio audience. If your business or organization is interested in learning more, please visit mainpublic.org and click on support and connect your business with our audience. Or call Dionysia Gaddis at 800-884-1717. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the end of the war in Afghanistan and the 20 years since 9/11. My guest, Congressman Jared Golden, representing Maine's 2nd District. He enlisted in the Marines after 9/11 and was deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Our other guest, John Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, providing independent analysis to policymakers about foreign policy. John Sopko, we discussed the work that you've done since 2012, looking at what the U.S. has been doing in Afghanistan. Your work is not over, is it?
No, it actually isn't. And apropos of that, we just got a letter from a senior oversight committee. It was a bipartisan letter of both Republicans and Democrats asking us to look at a lot of questions. And I think these are questions that the American people have, and we do. I mean, why after $86 billion and 20 years of support, the Afghan military and police collapsed within a matter of weeks? Why did the Afghan government, which got billions of dollars of support and a lot of technical assistance, collapse and basically run away? What happened to all the money that was in the pipeline? What happened to all of the weapons we've left? And did we do an appropriate job in sort of turning the spigot off of money flowing in to Afghanistan? You have to realize 70 to 80% of the Afghan government's budget for the last 20 years has been paid for by the U.S. taxpayer. So money was flowing right up to the bitter end. So what happened to that? And also, what happened to all of the soldiers, the female judges, the female prosecutors, investigators, and other people have been left behind? So there's a lot of questions for us to look into, and we're glad we got a request from the House Oversight Committee, and we're going to march out and do that because we have the expertise. We've been there for years. We've been looking at it for a number of years. So we're happy to do that. And that's probably going to be, you know, our last hurrah is trying to answer these questions that members of Congress and I think the American people have.
And Congressman Jared Golden, you think this is a really important point, that the questions are not done being answered.
This is a critical point. First, we need to be turning a critical eye to the Biden administration's handling of the withdrawal itself. But we also have to ask hard questions, not only about the last weeks and months, or last 6 months under this administration, or the last 4 years under the Trump administration, who really started direct negotiations with the Taliban for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. But we got to look back over the entire 20 years. I think John has a lot to say about how we fought many different 1 year almost battles and strategies without an overarching strategy for success and what we were trying to achieve in Afghanistan. So I think we absolutely owe it to the American taxpayer, but more importantly to our service members and the people that have sacrificed and given their lives, and to the victims of 9/11 to ask all of these tough questions, to have a very critical eye in looking back and looking for what did we get right, where did we go wrong, asking tough questions to not only have a better understanding as a country about what happened over the last 20 years in Afghanistan, but also to search for answers that can help us in being better in the future.
An email here from Holly. I spent a month in 2018 in Panjshir, Afghanistan, the last province to resist the Taliban, listening to stories of local women leaders and heads of health and education departments who were very clear about local solutions to their local problems. From this experience, I believe the news media is asking the wrong question about 9/11 and the war in Afghanistan. For Representative Jared Golden, why did Congress not regularly review the need for military force as required under the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, AUMF? It appears that once al-Qaeda was defeated within a few months of the AUMF in Afghanistan in 2002, Congress needed to debate the issue of how to best prevent the growth of extremist militant groups. And then for John Sopko, when we want to look at who the U.S. When we want to look at who in the USA benefited from pushing a military solution beyond 2002, what companies in the USA benefited? How much did their stocks rise? And how much did they pay in taxes for this increase in their assets? John, I'm going to start with you and then turn to Congressman Golden.
Well, that's a good question. I think... In defense of contractors, they do have a tendency to be brushed with some evil doers. A lot of good contractors did good work in Afghanistan, and yes, a lot of them made a lot of money. And we have indicted 136 people over the years we've been there. But we don't want to paint them all with the same brush. People talk about the 2,400 U.S. soldiers who died, but there were a lot of contractors who also died in the course of this war. So it's something to look at. It's something to look at how decisions were made and were they influenced by contractors. And I think just to touch on something that the congressman mentioned, there wasn't one bad decision or one bad administration. There's a lot of fault here to go around, and we need to look at all of it.
All right. And to you, Congressman Golden, yes. The question Holly's asking is about 2002. And to be clear, not only were you not a congressman there, you were a very young man about to signing up to serve in the U.S. Marines.
Correct. I joined the Marines in 2002 and deployed to Afghanistan in 2004 and Iraq in 2005 into 2006. And of course, I was elected to Congress in 2018. Since I got into Congress, I got to say I agree with you completely. In fact, I have worked across the aisle with some very conservative individuals, Congressman Massey, Congressman Roy, with some other Republican veterans like Congressman Gallagher and Meyer. And then Abby Spanberger, a Democrat who is a CIA agent, and we all of us have been pushing Congress since 2019 saying we need to debate these authorizations for the use of military force. We should replace the 01 AUMF with a 2020. Now we would say a 2021. If we can't do it that soon, a 2022 authorization for the use of military force that's structured to the realities on the ground today. And I think there should be a requirement that after voting for an AUMF, Congress should have to revisit them at a minimum every 12 months. I think that debate is a part of the responsibility of being, in particular, a member of the House of Representatives, the People's House, and the country would be better served if that debate were ongoing, and it would keep Congress in the game of oversight. And just one quick last point, I know then we have a caller. I really think that we need to go beyond just the Oversight Committee. I'm on the Armed Forces Committee. We just voted last week for a Liz Cheney, Jason Crow amendment. That's bipartisan as well, to create a commission to look back at the withdrawal, yes, and what's gone wrong, but also, as I said, the entire 20 years. And I hope that we'll look to people like John and their work as a good way, a starting point perhaps, to inform that discussion. And perhaps we'll send an invitation as well, John.
Calling in now, Travis Mills, retired United States Army Staff Sergeant who served in Afghanistan. He and his wife started the Travis Mills Foundation to help post 9/11 veterans who were injured in service. And he is the author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, Tough as They Come. Travis, thanks for calling in. So nice to hear from you. And I have to tell you, I was up in the Belgrade Lakes region recently and saw your facility there. It is beautiful. Congratulations.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate having me on. I hope everybody's having a fantastic morning. We have a lot going on at the foundation. We have a gala tomorrow night, and then we have an open house from 10 to 2 on Sunday, if anybody listening wants to come check out the, you know, the place and see kind of full effect of what we have going on at the retreat center. So good morning. Thanks for having me. And you're leading the horse to water here. So you tell me what I'm supposed to talk about, because I don't want to just ramble about nothing, you know.
Travis, I have to say, for so many people right now, this weekend is very somber. You're not sounding very somber.
Well, no, I was in eighth grade when the Twin Towers were hit. I understand the impact of what that did to our nation and how people responded. They rose up. You know, I never knew a country after eighth grade not being in war when I joined the service, just like Congressman Golden. We knew that we were going in to fight. There was no question of like, oh, am I going to? I signed up to go and fight. And, you know, it's unfortunate what happened, but we also have to realize the lives that were lost. A lot of the people that I knew in the military would want us to, just like on Memorial Day, remember their sacrifice, remember their family sacrifice, but understand who they were as a person and honor them. And, you know, a lot of my buddies would rather have me go out and smile and enjoy life because they are no longer able to do that, but they want, you know, they want you to live it for them, if you will. So I understand the importance of the day and the impact of what it had on our country, but I also understand that, you know, we went out, we did our job, we took down as many bad guys as possible, and you know, with 9/11 coming up and the 20-year remembrance, we have to realize that we never forget it, but we also, life goes on and we got to make the best of what we have because we never know when our last day is going to come.
Travis, what advice do you have for any veteran who may be struggling with how the events in Afghanistan unfolded in the last few weeks, how watching the events, watching how quickly the Taliban moved in?
Well, you know, it's terrible. What I tell people is, well, the Taliban never went away. They always blended in with the population. You know, it's just like how we fought the Revolutionary War. So I wasn't surprised that the Taliban had the power and the strength to do what they did as quick as they did. And I wasn't surprised that the Afghan National Army fell so quick, because there's ones that believe in democracy and believe in country and believe that there's a, you know, a westernized way to live. And there's other ones that unfortunately don't have the pride that we take in having, you know, the opportunity to live in and be from America. And that's not a knock on them. It's just, it's, you know, you're fighting an ideology. So for me, I tell people we did our job. We did good. We worked hard. We, you know, built schools. We dug wells. We were able to give people a chance at seeing what freedom is and what freedom looks like. As well as, you know, now I tell people that we weren't allowed to win the war. It's not that we couldn't win a war. It's not that we weren't, you know, able to beat the enemy. It was that, you know, the powers that be didn't want us to do what we had to do to actually win a war like we did in World War II, which I'm not saying would be a good thing. But if you're not willing to go all in, then basically, you know, I was ready to get out of there. After I was injured, actually, not after I was injured. I knew after my first deployment that I went from my first to my left and my right. At the end of the day, I wasn't there for anything except to make sure that many Americans that were over there could come back to their family. Because that's all you want to do. You go over there and you want to come home. You want to get back to your family, get back to your iPhone, and get back to normal life here in America, because America is so fantastic.
Travis, I know Congressman Golden has something to say to you before we let you go back to your day. Go ahead, Congressman.
I certainly just wanted to say, Travis, thank you for your service and all that you've given to the country. You're such an inspiration to so many people and to many, many veterans out there, and you've committed yourself to a continued life of service to the men and women who have served our country, and I want to express just such admiration and appreciation to you. And you bring a positive spirit forward, and it's one that a lot of people out there need right now. So thanks for doing what you do and doing it with such, you know, just strong will and like I said, bringing that positive force out into the world. We really appreciate it. I look up to you, and I really enjoyed getting to know you. And he made a really good point. There's a great piece I read today by a guy named Andrew Basevich, and he leads with this quote: "The soul of an army can't be breathed into the army by a foreign military power or foreign military force on the ground." And he made the same point Travis did about the Continental Army fighting for independence. They knew what the soul of what they were fighting for was, and as a result, they stayed on the battlefield until they ultimately won. We can't instill that in members of the Afghan military. They have to know and decide what they're fighting for and whether or not it's worth it to them at the end of the day. But Travis, thank you so much. I look forward to continuing to get to know you and working with you any way I can.
And Travis, we look forward to having you back on Maine Calling. Good luck this weekend. Travis Mills, Army Staff Sergeant. He and his wife founded the Travis Mills Foundation, and we have a link to that on our website and Facebook page. We do need to take another quick break. We're running late. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Now You're Cooking, celebrating 21 years of selling cookware, kitchen tools, fine wine, and local beer on historic Front Street in downtown Bath. Open 7 days a week. And Lee Toyota of Topsom, featuring the new lineup of 2021 Toyota hybrid electric cars and SUVs, LeeToyota.com. And Panorama Organic, a U.S. producer of grass-finished beef and a proud partner of the National Audubon Society. Society's Conservation Ranching Program, available at Hannaford.
I'm Tanya Mosley, the second in command for the National Guard, remembers his role on 9/11 and trying to intercept Flight 93.
The reminder of that day, smelling the smoke and fumes coming up from the Pentagon, from the burning Pentagon, into the cockpit, so I was that close I could smell it.
The National Guard's role, post 9/11, next time on Here and Now.
You can hear Here and Now today from noon to 2 on Maine Public Radio. And Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of Maine State Music Theater's Jersey Boys. Jersey Boys will take you on a journey behind the music of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, the story of four blue-collar kids with a dream. Maine State Music Theater's Jersey Boys will be performed at the Westbrook Performing Arts Center now through September 19th. For complete details and tickets to the performance, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we are discussing the war in Afghanistan as we mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11. My guest, John Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction and Maine 2nd District Congressman Jared Golden. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. We're going to Peter, who is calling from Camden. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. First, I want to very much salute Jared for his service to this country, and John as well. John did an incredible job and is doing an incredible job. I read many of his reports. I had come out of Laos in the early 70s and gone across all the way to Paris. On the way, I went through Afghanistan, spent time there. Beautiful country, so fractured. We never glued the country together politically. And the corruption, which John documented and commented on, whether it was the drug trade or the fact that the Afghan security forces were so rough with their own people, that really never got resolved either. What I'm most concerned about right now, the Saudis, their role in all of this, including pumping money into Afghanistan, which was running counter to American interests. The Saudis have documents that people have seen in this country, and those documents are locked away, and the families want those documents released. That's, to me, a fundamental, objective to everything. We can't tell the story of Afghanistan without looking at the Saudi involvement in many aspects.
Okay, Peter, thank you. John Sopko.
Well, the issue raised about the Saudis is a little bit beyond what we look at, but I do know a lot of people have questions about the involvement of other countries in 9/11. And I believe the president recently announced a move to declassify a lot of the FBI documents related to 9/11. And maybe the congressman may know more about that. But I think the American people have a right to know what happened. And that's been one of the things we've fought for years, was the overclassification, the hiding, the spinning. I've seen too many generals and aide administrators spin so much they went 360 degrees and they looked like tops about us turning the corner. We're turning the corner. We're turning the corner. And then every time we looked closely, we weren't turning a corner, and then they'd classify something. And that makes me nervous. I mean, I've been in Washington since 1982. And I've learned one thing and one thing only, and that is that the U.S. government does not classify good news. And if by mistake it does, it will leak it. And that was one of the problems. And I think the congressman may talk about it himself, about how many times they weren't able to be told the truth of what happened. And I can't address the Saudi issue, but I can't say in Afghanistan, this came up time and time again, that Congress was being spun. And that's a problem. And I think the American people, we're the ones who pay for this. We have a right to know what is going on. And that is something we've raised for the last 10 years.
Yeah, one thing I would point out is that for many years, under many administrations, the families of 9/11 victims in particular have been demanding the release of information, of documents in the possession of the United States government about some of the details of what enabled 9/11, who else was involved. Some of this may speak perhaps to Saudi connections. And the decision has finally been made to go ahead and release those documents publicly as we near the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Long overdue, and I think a really important and positive step should have been taken a long time ago. And those families have stayed committed to getting the truth as part of justice, and I'm sure as part of the healing process. They deserve the right to know everything that the United States government knows, and so do we all. And so John makes a good point about some of the troubles with classification in our government, and that's something that Congress has to look into as well. The Pentagon Papers, or the Afghan Papers, I guess is what I should call them. They're out there. You can read them, and you should read them because it details, I think, very well the many statements that have been made publicly versus privately by the same individuals, generals, and many other leaders of our nation, showing a real disconnect between what was said publicly versus what they knew was going on in the ground in Afghanistan, similar to Vietnam. That the American people deserve better than that. We deserve to know what's going on, and our service members deserve, I think, to know, you know, what they're fighting for and what the reality of what we're getting out of it is. So I think that 2020, makes for perfect hindsight. Perhaps the time to get out of Afghanistan might have been after we got bin Laden. But John points out in his most recent report that the Taliban has been ascendant on the battlefield for about a decade, essentially since the Obama troop surge began to taper off in 2011. The Taliban has been winning battlefield victories against the Afghan National Army, and yet our generals have been saying, as John pointed out repeatedly, you know, we just need another year. You know, we're almost there. We're about to turn the corner, and I think we have to ask hard questions about that disconnect between the public rhetoric versus some of the private communications that were being received by the State Department and by the Pentagon, and how that got communicated to Congress and to the White House.
Peter, I want to thank you so much for your call. And John, I want to give you a chance to respond to what Travis Mills had to say. We had to go to a break quickly after his call. But, you know, Travis, such a powerful personality, such a voice of positivity. But he did say one thing negative. He said we were not allowed to win.
Well, on the war fighting, I don't know what he meant by that. I think we had problems from the beginning because we didn't really have a good strategy. And that goes back to read our report and read the congressman says, the Afghan papers. The Afghan papers are basically the interview notes from my staff interviewing all of these people for our lessons learned reports. We had about 600, 700 people we interviewed for these things, and they've been released. They're public, except for the names of people who wanted to be protected. You don't want names of people out there, particularly those who were in Afghanistan, because they could get killed or hurt. And it's likewise people. So I think I can't address it directly. what he raised, but I think the problems that we raise in our reports are problems with how the government, our government, does major operations like this. And one of the things that one of your other callers raised was we didn't really understand the context of Afghanistan, the how they operate, what worked and what didn't. And that's one of the serious problems. Before you go into a place like Afghanistan, know where you are. We're not in Maine. You know, we're not in Iowa. I used to joke, we're not in Norway. And we were designing programs for Norwegians. We were not designing programs for an illiterate tribal country, which has history of corruption going on and a lack of central government. We tried to create a little Norway or a little United States in our image and likeness. And that doesn't work if you don't understand the country.
Jared Golden, Congressman Golden, final thoughts.
Well, I'll just end again with you know, let's recognize tomorrow is 9/11, and as part of that, you know, we've had this conversation. I think the whole country needs to reflect on what we can take away from the experiences of the last 20 years in Afghanistan, but the entire global war on terrorism. But at the end of the day, very important. To honor the fallen, the sacrifices of our service members over these last 20 years. And we should never forget the victims of 9/11, their families, and the heroism of those first responders.
And you're hoping a memorial. There will be a memorial to them on the National Mall.
Yes. Myself and a big group of veterans, all of us in Congress, all fought in the global war on terrorism, are pushing the Biden administration. Before that, we were pushing the Trump administration. Let's build a memorial to the global war on terrorism in remembrance of the service members who gave their lives and everyone else that put on the uniform and served since then. Let's include in that our first responders who gave their lives on 9/11 and other people who served in agencies like the CIA, the FBI, and others that have been committed to protecting the homeland since 9/11. It's important for healing. It's important for the country, I think, to never forget I think demonstrates a commitment not only to showing appreciation and honoring our service members, but also will send a message that we're prepared to carry out this oversight that John and I are talking about being so important. We're not just going to gloss this over. Let's ask hard questions. Let's figure out what we did right. Let's figure out what went wrong and have accountability and then see what we can do with that information in the future.
Congressman Jared Golden, thank you so much for joining us today. Golden represents Maine's 2nd Congressional District. And John Sopko, also with us today from his cabin in Maine, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Today's sound engineer, Stella Mars. We had special technical help from John Bradford. Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith produce Maine Calling, and our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.